time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for June 22nd, 2019. Happy summer solstice, everyone. I hope you're enjoying the longer days and finding time for longer rides. So there's lots to talk about this week. If you haven't been following it and want to know more, check out the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page to see a variety of stories that crossed my desk this week. They range from great news for Olympic athletes with no small contribution from Nancy Hogshead Makar, who was my guest just a couple of weeks ago on the show, to the apprehension and arrest of a variety of criminal types who decided to make it open season on cyclists. Only somebody was watching. Another item that came across my desk this week prompted me to get in touch with Rails to Trails and with Eli Griffin, the manager for Trail Development Resources. The topic is rail banking, and I wanted to know more about it. Turns out it isn't a new phenomenon, and in fact, hundreds if not thousands of our trails are due to the practice. Eli's going to explain it when we talk with him in a moment. He'll also fill us in on some of the progress of the Great American Bike Trail. Then we'll have a quick chat with Molly Herford. She's the writer, coach, endurance athlete, and proud author of Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride. The much-anticipated book was just published by Random House Kids and is the first in the Shred Girls series. Finally, the always interesting, fun, and informative Dan Worry will join us to break down the Tour de France, which is coming up in 2 short weeks. With the untimely crash of Chris Froome at the Dauphiné and a so far lackluster spring for 2018 yellow jersey holder Thomas Geraint, it just might be anybody's guess as to who's going to stand atop the podium in Paris this year. We'll discuss that and a lot more. So let's head on down to Washington, D.C. to chat with Rails to Trails, Eli Griffin, and learn all about rail banking. Good morning, Eli. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
It's been a while since we caught up with Rails to Trails. I'm interested in something called rail banking. What is rail banking?
Yeah, so it's fairly complicated, so I'm going to try to keep it brief and as clear as possible. But at its most basic, it's a voluntary agreement between a railroad and a trail agency to use an out-of-service rail corridor for interim use as a trail until the railroad might need the corridor again for rail service. And that interim trail use has really preserved thousands of miles of rail corridor that otherwise would have been lost to abandonment, and in turn now is available for recreation and active transportation opportunity in communities around the country.
A question that comes up for me is, if it's only interim use, what happens when the railroad wants it back? What happens to that trail?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, it rarely happens. It's one of the key benefits of rail banking that it allows for that opportunity. And it's honestly one of the main reasons that Congress enacted rail banking in 1983. But in practice, we've probably only seen railroad reactivation happen a handful of times in the decades since. But typically, we recommend that trail managers include a provision in their rail banking agreement with the railroad that if reactivation were to occur, that they would be compensated for not only the purchase price that they paid to the railroad for the corridor itself, but also any improvements they made. Of course, any inflation factors or material cost factors, and perhaps reaccommodation of the trail alongside the railroad if reactivation were to occur.
So I guess another question that comes up for me is whether or not the railroad would then say, well, we can help you develop
because these trails have to go somewhere. We can help you develop something near the rail bed. I'm wondering, you said it rarely happens, so that's a good thing. But, you know, you sort of like, well, here's this cool trail, and then it's gone. So, you know, I wonder what happens in that regard, especially if it hooks up from one trail to another, you know, if it becomes like that.
Right. Yeah, and we see the few times it has happened, I think all but one or two of those, the railroad has allowed the trail to be reaccommodated alongside as what we call a rail width trail. So a trail open alongside an active line. And I think a large part of that reason is the railroad doesn't want to be the one, even though it's within their right under a rail banking agreement, they don't want to be the one to go into a community and say, hey, we're taking away this beloved community asset. So to the extent possible, they will typically try to work with the trail manager to reaccommodate that trail.
So this is one of those instances when maybe a transportation bill works in rails to trails favor as opposed to working in roads and bridges favor.
One of the few.
One of the few. So you said that Congress actually made this happen. So explain to me what that means. So who made the agreement? I mean, it's not just between the railroad and the trails. It's Congress is involved somehow.
Right. So they established the mechanism. And my understanding of the reason why they did that is because in the early 80s and the late 70s, there was a rapid rate of abandonment among the railroads. Mm. That was their original vision for rail banking. They were frankly panicking about what that would mean for the nation's transportation infrastructure if they would permanently lose these rail corridors. So they amended the National Trail System Act in 1983 to include this provision that basically says if a railroad and a trail manager wants to negotiate a completely voluntary agreement, we will keep the line that is up for abandonment under federal jurisdiction. It will essentially be out of service and available for that interim trail use and future reactivation, but the federal government will maintain authority. And that's through the Surface Transportation Board, who has authority over all freight railroads.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Eli Griffin. He is the manager of trail development resources for Rails to Trails. So why is it important that we're talking about rail banking now?
Yeah, well, you know, I always think it's important. Part of my job is to get the word out about this great opportunity. But there is an ongoing notice of proposed rulemaking at the Surface Transportation Board to make some procedural changes to the process. And we've been pushing back for a few months now at RTC using our data that we've collected for decades on some really negative rule changes that the STB was initially proposing. And those would have put a cap on rail banking negotiations, which we felt not only violated the statutory language and goals of rail banking, but also didn't match reality. You know, these are complex real estate transactions, and there are lots of players involved. And, you know, negotiations drag out for a variety of reasons. Fundraising needs to occur. So they were initially proposing a 3-year cap and then would on negotiations and then would consider extensions beyond that, but only in extraordinary circumstances. And we just felt that was too tough a standard to meet. So we pushed back on that. We got a ton of trail managers and some railroads to file in opposition. And then when we were crunching the numbers, we actually realized that a proposed change would be to extend the amount of time railroads and trail managers could negotiate in the initial period before extension requests need to kick in, from 180 days to a year. That better matches the data and the reality on the ground. So we proposed that. The STB ruled just earlier this month on both rulemaking proceedings, and actually it was very favorable to us. They're now proposing to extend that initial negotiating period from 180 days to 1 year, as we suggested. They are willing to grant up to 3 1-year extensions of that time period with the consent of the railroad and trail manager. And then for extensions beyond that, they will grant them if good cause is shown, which is a standard that is easier to meet and better matches the standard used in other contexts of the Surface Transportation Board. However, I know that's a lot.
There's always the catch. What is the however?
So the STB did include not favored language, and we're a little puzzled by that. But basically what they're saying is they won't favor extension requests beyond 3. but they will grant them if good cause is shown. And we have no idea what the impact of that would be because it's a standard that doesn't exist elsewhere. So we're pushing back on that now. We plan on filing our own comments in opposition to that one little piece, but in support of everything else. And we're encouraging others to do the same.
Ah, and that's where I was going to go next. So people who are listening to the show and people who are members of Rails to Trails, and if you're not a member, it's an outstanding organization. That's just my aside. What can they do? Where is the information so that if they want to weigh in, they can do that?
Yeah, so the Surface Transportation Board's website is a little clunky, as a lot of federal government websites are.
It's go figure.
Stuck a bit in the 1990s. So I think the best place to go would be to our own website, and I really encourage everyone to sign up for our Trail Expert Network, which is a community of 6,000-plus trail managers, friends group leads, trail advocates, trail planners, other trail professionals. And that's where we really message these kind of, you know, a little bit wonkier asks and wonkier ways to support these trail professionals. And we actually have a newsletter set to go out on Wednesday that will once again include all of this information, all the filing instructions, everything. So I just encourage everyone to go to railstotrails.org/10, T-E-N, and just sign up for our list there, and you'll get direct notification of this and any additional asks or any additional support down the line.
So I wanted to ask a question. It kind of loops back to the beginning of our conversation about how many miles of trails might be under the rail banking system that don't outright belong to the Rails to Trails organization that actually have this kind of agreement with the railroads. Do you know?
It's a lot. I don't have the numbers right in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah, I think last we checked, it was about a quarter of all rail trails, and there are more than 2,300 rail trails around the country and more than, I think, 23,000 miles or roughly in that range. So it's a large chunk. And really, that's because rail banking is the best way to preserve especially long corridors intact where you might not really be sure how the ownership was assembled centuries ago. It may have been easements that upon abandonment would revert to adjacent landowners, and this kind of puts a hold on that process and really allows trail development to occur when, you know, it might not if you had to then deal with hundreds and hundreds of landowners.
Right, right. I do remember having a conversation with somebody at the organization about the way trails are, you know, trailed land is acquired, and that came up, that the idea that, you know, part of it was railroad, but then they got easements from landowners and it could have been somebody's field and maybe he wants it back. Yeah, it's pretty complicated stuff. So,
and what we've seen even is that railroads often don't even know, which has kind of been a shock to us, but they don't even know what they own and what they don't own because record keeping wasn't so good back in the 1800s sometimes.
Sure.
And so this is a way that they kind of can say, oh, we'll reach a rail banking agreement. And honestly, then we don't need to think about it until abandonment might occur down the line in the future.
Right, right. Interesting. So interesting. Well, the last thing I want to ask you is, I know it isn't your purview to talk about the Great American Bike Trail, but we did announce it back in February. And I was just wondering, we talked to Kevin Mills at that time. I was just wondering if anything exciting has happened since then, or, you know, I mean, people are talking about this idea of being able to get on a trail and going from one end of the country to the other.
Yeah, I am super excited about it. I love it. I did just the Ohio to Erie ride not too long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, which is a large chunk of that is part of this route. And I love that kind of long distance riding, and I would love to do it, but it's also, you know, just huge for little communities along the way, for their economic development, for recreation. It's such an exciting project. But yeah, since February, we actually launched the official route. So in May, we had a series of kickoff events around the country. I actually attended the one in Three Forks, Montana to assist with that. And we launched our full website with a map of the route. And I really encourage everyone to check that out. There's lots of detailed information there, lots of history, lots of vision, and the map itself. And that's at greatamericanrailtrail.org. And now moving forward, we're kind of in the process of reviewing state plans and local opportunities. And we're we want to keep this momentum going. So sure. we're really trying to think how we can best fit in with local led efforts. And maybe that's through fundraising, maybe it's through planning or facilitation or promotion. And we're figuring out where we can best fit to try to help those efforts move forward so we can continue this really great momentum.
Well, you said you did the Ohio to Erie along the towpath.
Yep. Yeah, I did from Cleveland to Cincinnati.
That's where we live in Cleveland. We ride we ride the towpath all the time. We love it. It is wonderful.
It's amazing.
It is. Well, again, we've been speaking with Eli Griffin. He is the manager of trail development resources for Rails to Trails. We've been talking about rail banking and the Great American Bike Trail. For more information, you can go to railstotrails.org if you're interested. And thanks so much for talking with me. We will catch up again.
Sure. It was a pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Eli Griffin is the manager of trail development resources for Rails to Trails. If you're interested in the rail banking petition or the Great American Bike Trail, or you'd just like to get in on the e-newsletters that the organization makes available, you can log on to railstotrails.org. So let's take a short break, and we'll return to talk with author Molly Herford about her new young reader's book, Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Ordinarily, when we talk with Molly Herford, she's giving us great advice about apparel, accessories, and tips on riding more comfortably. But we've also known that she's been working on a series of books for young girls. And the first volume, Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride, was just published last month. Hey, Molly, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and congratulations on the publication of Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a very, very long time in the making, so it's been a super exciting month.
Well, it's a lovely book. It's hardbound. It is lavender. Every girl will like it. It's got a cute illustration, and in fact, I don't know Violet LeMay, but she did do the illustrations throughout the book, so we should give her a little shout out, yes?
Yes, she is amazing. And I honestly, she must have like gone in my head and just dragged out exactly what I wanted. I cried the first time I saw the initial sketch of what the girls would look like. I was so happy.
Well, they are cute. They're very cute. And I like that Lindsay's actually got like goggles on the cover or glasses. That's awesome. Anyway, so the book is published by Random House Children's Books, which is awesome. Tell us a little bit about the backstory. What the book was meant to be and for whom, and then we'll talk about the actual content.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have Random House kind of on board with it. I had initially thought, oh, this will just be a little thing I self-publish. It was just this book that needed to get written. It just wouldn't get out of my head. And then I was lucky enough that, you know, it caught the eye of an editor at what was then Rodale Kids, which eventually got bought by Random House, which is why it's taken so long to get it out. There was a lot of shuffling in the publishing world in the last couple of years. For me, that was the most exciting thing, because now instead of just reaching cyclists that I know to hopefully, you know, get some more young cycling girls reading, it's actually reaching a much wider audience of, you know, more normal young girls like me when I was that age that don't know about cycling, but are bookworms and love reading. So I've heard a few girls have picked it up and are, you know, demanding that their parents get them bikes, and they're getting out on their bikes and stuff. And it's been amazing.
Oh, that is awesome. That's wonderful to know that it's already having an effect. So it is one of a series. It is the first of a series. Tell us, who is Lindsay? And it's really cute because she keeps sort of this,
She's got her training log.
Yes, she keeps her training log, which is sort of her diary. And I like that she calls it a training log. So tell us a little bit about Lindsay and how you came up with her as your sort of protagonist, your character.
Yeah, absolutely. So Lindsay is, you know, in the beginning of the book, she's a young girl who really wants to be a superhero. She's just absolutely convinced that at some point her parents, who of course are archaeologists, are going to come back from a dig with some kind of artifact that she's going to touch, and she's going to magically get these superpowers. She's going to be able to save the world. She's very much like myself at that age, where she's comic book obsessed and loves reading and does that stuff. So initially her training log is much more her training to become a superhero. She's much more convinced that that's her pathway. But then her parents get called away on an archaeological dig, and without too many spoilers, she gets stuck with her cousin, who she's convinced is a supervillain. And as it turns out, her cousin, spoiler here, is not a supervillain in real life, but does in fact bring her, you know, on into this bike park, and she discovers that, you know, maybe she can't actually fly, but when she's on a bike and hitting a jump, it pretty much feels that way. So, you know, for me, she's so based on who I was at that age, just this, you know, kind of nerdy little girl who has no real interest in sports. But then, you know, I wish someone had shoved me into cycling, because I think I would have loved it if I'd come to it earlier.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that cycling can be sort of a solo thing, so that somebody who isn't maybe very outgoing can still get on a bike and do some really cool things, like jump and fly, you know, thinking that you are.
Exactly.
But she does kind of hook up with some other people besides her cousin, and they do some other things. I don't want to spoil the story. Shred Girls is supposed to be for ages 8 to 12. How did you and why did you pick that age group? What is it about that age group that you think will not only enjoy the book, but will get something that might motivate them towards cycling?
So for me, this age is, and research backs this up, this age is when most girls tend to quit sport altogether. And, you know, bikes in particular are one of the things that they give up. There's so many statistics out there that around age 10 for girls, there's a huge drop off in the sports that they play for a bunch of different reasons. By the age of 14, girls are dropping out of sports at twice the rate that boys are. So to me, if, you know, if we can kind of make sports seem more normalized for girls, you know, so part of this book is because I loved the Babysitter's Club. I was obsessed with Nancy Drew when I was a kid. I love series like that. And I mean, if I could start babysitting because I read the Babysitter's Club, that's a boring thing to do. Bikes are a cool thing to do and a really fun thing to do. So, you know, I'm hoping I can kind of get in while they're impressionable and convince them that cycling is actually this really cool sport that's worth sticking with, instead of, you know, hanging up your bike at age 9 or 10, which is exactly what I did, and not coming back to it till you're in your 20s. You lose so much time, especially when it comes to developing skills on the bike. That's the formative years, and that's where you can really, you know, just nail those skills and have this confidence. And I think the bike is just such a valuable tool for young girls.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Molly Herford. When we talk to her, most of the time, she's giving us advice about apparel and gadgets and gadgets that we use in cycling. But we've been waiting for her book, Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride. It is out now on Random House Children's Books. It's a little hardbound book. It's really well done. And so people can already order it online. Can they go to the bookstore? Where is it?
Yeah, I think that's the most exciting thing is I've, you know, gotten people sending in pictures of it in independent bookstores and Barnes & Noble. Of course, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold, basically. It's been really neat actually seeing it, you know, in bookstores.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's the shred-girls.com website where, you know, there's all the book information, but then I also have tons of profiles of young, what I call shred girls in real life. So from ages, I think 6 is the youngest, up till, I think we've got a couple 30-year-olds on there, just kind of talking about how they got into cycling, where they've, you know, where they've gone, and their best tips for riding bikes and for making friends in cycling. Because, as you said in the beginning, it's great because you can do it solo, but it's pretty fun if you can find a couple friends. Maybe not for every ride. Maybe you still like the solo ride, but it's nice to have a couple friends every once in a while.
So are you already working on volume two?
Yeah, book two actually is going to be out next summer. So the edits for that just went in last week. So I'm really excited about that. Spoiler alert, downhill mountain bikes are involved. I think book three is going to be bike packing. So I'm super stoked on that.
So basically you're sort of letting these girls grow up and letting the bike progress with them. So BMX
exactly.
to downhill to bike packing. That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, Molly, I wish you so much luck with the book. Again, Molly Herford, Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride. You can find out more about Molly and all the work she does at theoutdooredit.com and shred-girls.com. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. As always, it's so much fun to chat with you.
Yeah, it is. I wish you so much luck with the book. Talk to you soon. Bye. Molly Herford is the author of Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride. You can learn more about Molly's work with young girls and get a copy of the book at shred-girls.com or read her blog, theoutdooredit.com. We're going to take another short break and get ready for our pre-Tour de France chat with Dan Worry. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm your host, Diane Jenks. It's going to be an interesting Tour de France this year. There's no singular favorite who stands out to win the race. Velo News' Dan Worry and I are going to dive into that and a lot more in our pre-Tour de France chat. Hey, good morning, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's almost TDF time.
It is, and I'm always glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Diane.
Well, I'm always happy to talk with you. My listeners always like to hear what you have to say, and we will talk about the Tour de France, but I think we need to do an update on Mr. Chris Froome.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about the Tour de France, it's hard not to talk about this story, you know, and the big headline is that Froome is out. He's not going to be at the 2019 Tour de France. He had a terrible crash in a practice run at the Critérium du Dauphiné. And you know how, you know, as a cyclist, I'm sure you know this, Diane. You know, it occurs to me as I'm riding, you know, there's just you need to lose focus for just like a fraction of a second for something really not good to happen. Right. So Froome in this case was needing to blow his nose and was doing it, unfortunately, at more than 30 miles an hour. And he hit a wall. And when I say he hit the wall, I don't mean metaphorically like we do sometimes in endurance sports. He literally hit a wall and, you know, went down very, very hard. And so is out. In fact, has sustained really very, very serious injuries. He was left with fractures to his neck. He broke his right femur. He has fractures in his elbow and in his ribs as well, and a broken hip out of the thing. So huge orthopedic injuries all throughout his body for Froome. So, you know, that is a crash that not only will certainly ruin his Tour de France for this year, but he's very lucky to have survived a crash even like this. I mean, a very serious crash, was airlifted to the hospital. Doctors think he will be back on the bike, but it is pretty safe to assume that 2019 is done for him. His surgeon says that he'll likely be off the bike for 6 months. And so, you know, at a top level like this, that's a very long time to be away from the sport. Certainly others have mounted big comebacks after substantial injuries, but boy, this is a doozy. So, I mean, really, really disappointing news. He has been moved to a rehabilitation center in Monaco. He's still not, even at this point, after about 2 weeks, in condition that he's able to actually return home even to continue his recovery right now.
So, how old is he now?
Very, very scary stuff. He is in his mid-30s, early.
Yeah, so healing is not going to be like when he was in his 20s.
That's right. And so, we'll see what this means long term. But we, you know, certainly wish him well. And it's a scary stuff for him. He's got, two little kids, a very sweet family. And so, you know, sad news for them and for him, and sad news for cycling.
Right. Well, it's interesting. When we spoke earlier in the year, you know, the question was, is Froome going to be able to come back this year in the Tour? And clearly he is not so.
Yeah, you know, I really thought the answer was going to be yes. You know, I thought that last year was sort of an outlier for him. You know, Geraint Thomas, you know, managed to have a little bit better form last year. And it was, I think, that maybe some level of awkwardness when your teammate suddenly takes yellow. But, you know, I really... you know, thought that maybe Froome would be back this year, but obviously now that will not be the case.
No, that is true. That is true. So before we actually get, you know, deep into the Tour de France, and it may not be as interesting for our rabid continental cycling fans, but two South American riders, this always blows my mind, were caught doping with recombinant EPO out of competition at the Campagnolo Gran Fondo in New York. What the heck? Why are these older riders trying to compete in a Gran Fondo, and then both riders get nailed for doping?
Doping at a Gran Fondo. I mean, you know, you never cease to be amazed, unfortunately, in this sport. But this is a particularly sad sort of situation. You know, you're right. These two riders, one from Colombia, one from Argentina, it tested positive for EPO, and these were sort of technically out of competition controls, but they were conducted right around the time of this Campagnolo GFNY World Championship Grand Fondo that was held in late May. You know, both of these guys were randomly selected out of the testing pool as riders who had kind of a legitimate chance of placing in the top 10 or maybe winning their age group. So anyway, they both tested positive, and they're going to have lifetime bans from the events. I mean, this is it's a competitive event. Obviously, it is an event that kind of bills itself as allowing amateurs to sort of experience what it's like to be in a pro race for a day. So they have the doping controls. It is a competitive environment, so it's. You know, it is open to both amateurs and professionals in this particular case. So it's not as though these guys were doping to win the local century ride, but still, I mean, just amazing the length that some will go to, and the jeopardy that they, you know, place their own health.
Right.
Into,
you would think about that too, right?
Yeah. So it's just a sad story, always sad to see, but maybe the bigger story in all of this, Diane, is that we're after a couple of years where it was very quiet, we're seeing EPO start to sort of come back into the news. This is not only a story here recently, with these guys at the Gran Fondo in New York. A couple weeks back, Trek Segafredo actually had to suspend one of their riders, Jarlinson Pantano. He's a 30-year-old rider, and came back himself as a pro in the World Tour with an adverse finding for EPO. Another rider, an Argentinian rider, Daniel Zamora, who'd been participating in the Vuelta San Juan, also was suspended for 4 years here in the past couple of weeks for EPO. So, we kind of think of EPO as being a bygone thing in the bad old days of cycling. But it's been interesting to watch here in recent months how it seems to be creeping back into the news.
Rearing its ugly head, as we say. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with our man, Dan Worry. We're talking about racing this year. We've gotten through the spring classics. We're moving on to the big guns, as we like to say. The Tour de Suisse will wrap up today. Well, actually tomorrow. You and I are talking on Friday. And Mr. Sagan had the yellow, and then he didn't. What's happening there?
He had it, and then he did. You know, the Tour de Suisse is always an interesting race to watch at this time of year because it is one of the really big kind of precursors to the Tour de France. And, on a smaller scale, it's certainly a much smaller number of stages, but combines as a stage race, sprint stages and more mountainous stages. So it's like a little kind of microcosm of, what we might expect to see in terms of form at the Tour. So, certainly, as you said, one of the exciting
things to pick up on here on the Tour de Suisse is that Peter Sagan, seems to be really coming back into form. He held the yellow jersey there for a couple of days. When you and I last spoke at the end of the Classic season, Diane, we talked a little bit about Sagan, who had a respectable Classic season, but didn't come away with the really big wins that maybe he has in years past, or that people have just sort of instinctively come to expect of him. It's always kind of silly to describe, what he actually did accomplish during this Classic season as a disappointment, but he's one of those riders that is just so dynamic and, so prone to winning that we come to expect that he's going to be the top dog in all of these incredibly difficult races where he actually had very respectable showings, but now to see him just a couple weeks out from the Tour, coming into form and holding the yellow jersey there during some of the sprint stages at the Tour de Suisse, I think bodes very well for him going into the Tour and looking for yet another in his a sizable collection of green jerseys.
He's going to need a whole room for them, or a whole closet for them.
the other big news, sort of to watch is sort of how he has been replaced in the yellow jersey. Egan Bernal of Team Ineos has overtaken him now as they've gone into the mountains. And so, he's a young guy. It'll be interesting to see if he is able to, to hold on to the race lead through the weekend and come away with a very big, very big win for his career. And then, the associated story there is that on Team Ineos, which, by the way, I know we're going to talk about this a little bit later, is the new name for what we have known for many years as Team Sky.
Right.
His teammate last year's Tour de France winner, Geraint Thomas, was participating at the Tour de Suisse and actually crashed out a couple of days ago. Seems to be okay. It sounds like he suffered some cuts primarily to his back and above his eye. And so, they haven't released a ton about where he is and how he is, but it sounds as though he certainly will be able to line up for the Tour. But, being bumped out of a race like this, does not help to have these racing days leading up to the Tour. So,
well, that's one and two. We go Froome and Geraint, and now what, right?
Yes, and so, I think everybody took sort of a collective gasp when they heard that he had crashed out of the Tour de Suisse, because that would have been, absolutely catastrophic. I mean, sort of an unusual situation for Team Ineos with Froome and Thomas sort of to have, kind of co-leaders maybe of the team, but to have, to think that both of them might have been out of contention would have been really, really tough on the team. So we'll see how things go, but hopefully Thomas will still line up for the Tour.
Right. Well, before we do want to talk about the Tour, but we want to talk about something kicking off on July 5th, and that's the women's Tour, the Giro d'Italia Femminile Nil, or however in the hell you say it.
I like to call it the Giro Rosa.
Yeah, it is. It's the Giro Rosa, and I'm not sure why they have to have this, 14-letter thing going. But from July 5th through 14th, the ladies are going to get some good race coverage this year. Both Trek and Vox Women are doing hour-long coverage after each stage, which is kind of cool. So who's looking good for the Rosa, Giro Rosa?
Well, the Giro Rosa, I would tell you, it's interesting because it is still far enough out that we don't even have a complete start list for the race. But, at this point, I would point to Lizzie Deignan of Trek Segafredo. She just won the OVO Women's Tour, narrowly beating out Kasia Niewiadoma of Canyon SRAM. So, I think those two are really going to be riders to watch there. Mariana Voss, obviously, is a name that we've talked about many times over
the
years.
Yep, always in there.
To really be, she was out of the sport for a little while and really seems to be recovering and, kind of back into form. So she'll be interesting to watch. As an American cycling fan, it's sort of, the Giro Rosa is a little bit sad because, in recent years, we have had in Mara Abbott and Megan Gornier, some homegrown talent who has been really, you know, at the top of that list in recent years. Both of those women have retired from the sport at this point and are doing great in their future pursuits. But, you know, it's a bittersweet to not have those great American favorites still in the mix that we had, you know, talked about so many times on the Giro Rosa. But, you know, as you mentioned, maybe the most exciting thing leading into the race, you know, before the race begins, is this coverage. You know, women's cycling, you know, persistently has this challenge of developing fans when there's just very limited coverage. And so, you know, the Trek and Vox Women are, you know, coming together. You know, it won't be a full on, you know, live coverage of every stage of the race, but to put together an hour each night, sort of, you know, highlighting what happened. You know, this is sort of the grand tour for women at this point. And so, you know, to be able to have that sort of attention and, you know, an ability for women cycling fans to track the race and follow the riders over the course of that race is going to be really tremendous. So kudos to them for putting that on.
I find it really interesting that they're taking an hour and wrapping it up. And for people who don't sit in front of a television and watch, or in front of their computer and watch every single pedal stroke in the Tour or in or whatever, or, you know, the Vuelta, that you're going to get good coverage, solid coverage, and maybe you can digest it even better than just seeing every single stage and sort of getting mesmerized by it, you know?
Yeah, you know, it takes a hardcore fan to, you know, to want to watch, you know, even you know, for people who spend much of July in front of the TV right, watching the Tour, you know, we recognize that on most days, at least here in the States, that the broadcast version of the Tour, even if it's 3 or 4 hours long, it picks up in most cases several hours after the riders have already been going. So
right,
you know, it's a really long, grueling days. And so it's, it takes a particular type of fan to want to, you know, sit and watch 7 hours worth of bike racing when, you know, we recognize that in a lot of these stages, I mean, there are kind of pivotal moments that are really going to determine and, you know, probably not, you know, the neutral start of these stages and, you know, watching the early breakaway.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll dive into the Tour de France and what we might or might not see this year. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. If you're just joining us, Dan Worry is here with me to break down the Tour de France. The race begins in a short couple of weeks, and apparently we have no clear top contender. So let's unpack the granddaddy of them all, the 2019 Tour de France. So it is going to start in Brussels, apparently?
It will, yes. Stage one going to start in Brussels, and we'll actually be in Belgium for 2 days.
Yeah, I saw that. What's that all about?
You know, it's a great way. You know, frequently these grand tours actually have their starts in places other than kind of the main home. You might remember, and it's a shame it didn't come to pass, but several years ago there was talk about you know, holding the start of the Giro d'Italia in the Washington DC area, and they couldn't figure out how to make that happen with, you know, it's such a long transfer for the riders. But it's very common, you know, with these grand tours that they, you know, they start in kind of a unique location for the first couple of days. It's a great way for the races to sort of promote themselves outside of their home countries and get that excitement internationally.
Well, and I remember, was it just last year that the Giro had, what, the first three stages in the Middle East, in Israel?
I believe you're right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they can figure it out over there. But yeah, I mean, it would be tough here. So, Geraint Thomas, is he still considered maybe the favorite? Well, since he crashed, but is he still considered the favorite, you think?
You know, I no offense to Geraint Thomas, but I this is an unusual tour to me, Diane. Watching, you know, having been a fan and a follower of this sport for a long time, this particular tour to me is more kind of up in the air than any I can think of during the time that I have been closely following the sport. Froome, as I mentioned to you earlier, is somebody that I really thought had a great opportunity to come back this year, and is obviously out. Thomas is the defending champion, is certainly a strong contender, but his season so far has really not been anything but a little lackluster. So, you know, we'll see. He ended up out of contention, obviously, crashing out of the Tour de Suisse. So, you know, it's a little unusual. And if you think about the Tour in over the past decade plus, we were having this conversation, I would tell you that there has almost always been one or two or three kind of super big favorites for that race. If you think about kind of the big names who have won the Tour in recent, obviously Armstrong for many years, and that's a whole different topic. Alberto Contador, Brad Wiggins, Chris Froome has won the race four times. What was Team Sky, now Team Ineos, has won that race for six of the past 7 years. And so, we've had these really dominant Grand Tour riders, and you think about that race, it really is sort of unique. I mean, to be a Tour de France winner takes something that a lot of riders don't have. And we think about sprinters, who have a particular skill set and body type, and we think about climbers who are especially adept and tend to be very small and light and nimble in the mountains. But it really takes somebody special to win the Tour de France, a real kind of all-rounder rider. And those riders aren't out there in great numbers. And from being out and with some of the retirements here recently, we have some opportunity here for this to really be up in the air this year in a way that I don't feel like it has in a very, very long time. It's obviously always up in the air because in cycling, anything can happen. Sure. And, one bad moment and the favorite can, can crash out or no longer be in contention. But I would tell you, I think Thomas has certainly an opportunity. I think, we look at somebody like Vincenzo Nibali, perhaps, who, came in second at the Giro and really has, I think, of the, of the expected field, kind of the greatest Grand Tour pedigree out of all of the riders that are going to be there. Though, he's just coming off the Giro. And so, we talked about it's important to have race days before they go into a Tour, but there's also a question of just how many and how grueling those race days need to be to come in kind of at peak form for the Tour. So, Nibali certainly has the chops and the pedigree to do it, but the idea of winning the Giro and the Tour back to back is something that has been challenging for many riders over the years. And then there's a whole list of Astana's Jakob Fuglsang is somebody who's done quite well. He won the Dauphiné here recently, but he's somebody who has said he's not sure he's got the legs to deal with a 3 week Grand Tour, particularly during that third week in the high mountains. Richie Porte is another.
He was the one I was just going to ask you about because so Velo News published the Grandest Tour. It's a Tour de France guide, and they really rate him very highly.
Yeah, Porte is a very, very talented rider, and the thing, and it's certainly no fault of his own, but boy, he has, he may be a nominee for like the most unlucky,
right?
A Tour de France rider in recent years, because here's a guy who, certainly when he was on Team Sky was a huge support to Chris Froome, and went off to BMC and then subsequently now to Trek Segafredo, but he is one of those riders that seems to have every year. He's crashed out a number of times, or has had some some mishap that even if it didn't put him out of the race has you know, put him far out of contention. So, you know, he's definitely, I think he and Nibali are people to watch. And, you know, if Port could have, you know, that perfect tour that he certainly deserves after all of his mishaps over the years, boy, he could be the one to put it all together.
Well, we have Quintana too.
Yeah, you know, and when I was talking about the all-rounders earlier, Quintana is somebody who, you know, has shown this tremendous promise for years, but where he really comes alive is in the mountains. I mean, he is a phenomenal climber, but, you know, on some of the other aspects, you know, that you need to put it all together, time trialing, for example, he's certainly a better time trialist than I am, Diane. So I'm not knocking him, but I will say, you know, that's been a place where if you don't have that very top end edge over the rest of the field, you know, it becomes challenging. So, you know, if you do really well in the mountains, but not quite as well in those other aspects of this, you know, very multidimensional race, then, you know, that tends to put you out of contention. So, you know, the exciting thing about this year, though, is that somebody, I think, that maybe has not been a Tour de France winner is going to take this year.
That would be really cool to see somebody new on the podium.
To see who steps up. And you know, Geraint Thomas, wish you the best and good luck. I'm not sure I'm seeing the form there. So I think, you know, this one's going to be more open-ended than a tour that we've had in a very long time.
So there are two other things before I let you go. One is you alluded to the fact that there have been some team name changes, one being Ineos instead of Team Sky. And the other is I'm wondering if there is a specific stage that you think might be the sort of break or make the race this year. You know, we have 22 stages, and we know where it starts, we know where it ends. Is there a stage that you think might make or break the race? And you can say, I don't know.
You know, that's exactly what I'm going to do. It is very hard to predict. You know, we were just talking about all of, you know, I talk about Richie Porte's mishaps, for example. I mean, you know, it's easy to look at some of the big mountain stages always and sort of say, oh, well, that's going to be the really decisive stage of the tour. But that doesn't tend to really be, you know, how things work out in these grand tours. We've got three entire weeks of racing across, you know, thousands of kilometers. And, you know, it is frequently just these unexpected things that happen along the way that, you know, that we can look back at in hindsight and say, wow, that was, you know, that was really kind of the decisive thing that happened.
Like 8 seconds maybe at a time trial?
That's right.
Well, let's talk about the teams real quick. So we've got... Wait, I knew the number, and now I don't remember what the number is of how many. There are two types of teams. There's a continental team, and then there's a something else.
The World Tour.
The World Tour team. So who else has changed names besides Team Sky that we might recognize? Or are there any new teams who have finally been invited to the tour?
Well, you know, we've had a good number of changes. You know, probably the biggest changes, though, that, you know, that people are going to notice the most relate to two of the really big World Tour teams. Obviously, you know, and we've alluded to it throughout, you know, Team Sky Media decided, you know, that their sponsorship of cycling had sort of run its course. And so, you know, what was once Team Sky is now Team Ineos. Ineos is a petrochemicals company that has taken on sponsorship of the team. So, you know, when you hear about Team Ineos, don't be surprised. And you can sort of equate that back to Team Sky. Likewise, you know, one of the other kind of very longstanding presences in the sport, BMC, has, you know, is no longer following the death of their owner, Andy Reese, is no longer involved. And so they have become Team CCC, which I won't even attempt to pronounce the actual name that stands for, but it is a Polish shoe company that is sponsoring that team. And so, you know, as you look at the others, I think, you know, most of the others have been in place for at least a year or two. But it's always interesting, you know, as you look at the sport, not only do riders turn over, but, you know, team sponsors turn over. You know, we have these teams that, you know, over the years, you can sort of trace back that it's the same team, but it's, you know, unlike baseball or football, where you have these, you know, decades long association with a particular name. You know, we know now that, you know, that EF Education First is the former Slipstream, is the former Garmin, is the former Garmin Sharp. You know, just goes on and on. So
you really need to follow team members almost, as opposed to team names.
That's true.
Right. Like BMC has, I can never say his name, Matt. Greg
Van Avermaet.
Van Avermaet, yes. You know, and so if he's the one you follow, whatever it says on the jersey really matters less than how he's doing in the race.
That's right.
Well, anything you want to wrap it up with? How do you think cycling is faring overall in 2019?
You know, I think I was saying to a friend the other day, I think cycling is in sort of a transitional place, and it's always, you know, it's always going to be that way. Riders come and go, and you know, as we were talking about, teams and, you know, kind of sponsors come and go over the years. But, you know, I, you know, just sort of reflecting back here, even over the past, you know, years since I began at Velo-News, you know, I mean, a lot of the very big names in the sport that you know, you're with Fabian Cancellara and Tom Bonin and Alberto Contador. And I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. The, you know, the names that have been sort of the biggest names in the sport, by and large, are out of the sport at this point. And that's, you know, that's a natural thing and an okay thing, not necessarily a good thing for fans when the, you know, when those favorite riders, you know, kind of run their course and their careers. It's obviously something that you do for a limited period of time. So, you know, a lot of, you know, changes to team names, a lot of new faces. But I think, you know, this year's tour, as we were talking about, you know, maybe the lack of a big five-star favorite makes this tour a little bit more interesting this year, because, you know, it's as interesting as it has been to watch, you know, a Chris Froome, for example, just pull off kind of these flawless tour performances. You know, that becomes a little stale after a while when you, you know, kind of from the early stages of the tour, you kind of expect, you know, here's the person who's likely to be the winner. And lo and behold, they're, you know, out to this early lead that they keep largely throughout the tour. This year, it's anyone's guess as to who's going to come away. I mean, I think it is likely that we will have a tour winner this year who is, you know, one of these names that we've always talked about as a contender who has just never really been able to put it all together, and that this is going to be the year for that person. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Well, I guess, Dan, that it is remains to be seen what happens. It's going to be an interesting tour this year. I know this is going to sound a little selfish, but I'm kind of excited about the fact that we don't know. We don't really even have a clue who might show up as the standing at the top of the podium this year. That's so cool.
It is cool. And, you know, that's sort of always the case, but, you know, frequently not. But, you know, I mean, anything can happen at the tour. But by and large, we've had a pretty, you know, I mean, it's been a long time, Diane, since I have been able to say to you, I just don't know. I mean, I really genuinely don't even have a great guess as to who's going to come out on the top this year. And that really is kind of exciting.
It is exciting. Well, as always, it's interesting, it's informative, and it's fun. I'm so happy to talk with you. And I guess we'll have to chat after the tour and see who does stand at the top of the podium for 2019.
Let's do it.
All right. Great. Thanks for talking with me.
You bet. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye. Dan Mori is always a great guest with so much insight into the world of competitive road racing. I guess we'll just have to see what happens in this year's Tour de France. I hope you enjoyed the show. My thanks to Dan, to Molly Herford, and to Eli Griffin for joining me. We'll be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist, including a chat with the ever dapper Mr. Gary Fisher and a conversation about eggs. Yep, eggs. Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at OutspokenCyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. If you enjoyed the show, won't you leave a review at your favorite podcast app, or just click that 5-star rating. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.